I'd like now to welcome to the program Eileen Everett. She is an environmental and climate change educator. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So how did you get into all of this environmental and climate change education?
So my background is actually being a wildlife biologist, and I used to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and got into environmental education back in 2004 and worked for Audubon, New Mexico, and then went into business for myself back in 2008 and took on developing the climate change programming for the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science.
And one of the things that is so interesting in a kind of horrifying way is how little the American public still knows or understands about what is going on.
It's very interesting. And thinking about looking just at our school system, that there really aren't standards and benchmarks that directly address global warming and climate change. So even within our schools, and our kids right now aren't necessarily getting information about this today.
So where are their parents getting or not getting information?
So like everyone, you know, most of our information comes from the general media, whether it be listening to the radio like we are today, or reading the papers, or watching television is where we get most of our information. One of the biggest challenges that I faced as a climate change educator is trying to get people to better understand how to weed through the information and get to the science behind climate change.
And of course, science journalism is a whole interesting and important subject all by itself. First of all, there isn't the science journalism that there used to be because of the state of journalism today, but also it's not easy for science journalists to distill the vast amounts of information into accurate, current, digestible bits.
Very true. And I know for myself, being someone who's interested in climate change, I am just completely overwhelmed by the amount of information that comes out every single day about this topic and related to this topic. And science journalists have a really challenging job in themselves. And it's great when people actually read information that comes from science journalists, but I think most of the public doesn't necessarily seek out science journalists to get that kind of information. So again, I think one of our biggest challenges is how do we teach the American public to weed through the information that they actually are receiving and try to figure out where the science is in that information.
And how do you teach them that?
I think it's really thinking about where are you getting your information from. Is it coming from a peer-reviewed journal? Or is it coming from an op-ed article in the paper? And if you're reading an op-ed article in the paper, where is the science in that article? Where are the facts? And how is that information presented?
And there's also the ubiquitous disinformation campaign that is part of the, the fossil fuel industry, the kind of, what would you call it, super right-wing media establishment, all of that.
And I think one of the biggest challenges is, again, trying to look at, is the information you're looking at, is it coming from a place of opinion, from a place of politics, from a place of emotion, or is it based in science? And really, when you think about the topic of climate change and global warming, if you look at the science is very clear that exists out there, as long as you make sure you do your best to take the politics and the emotions out of it.
So when you take the politics and the emotions out of it, what are you left with?
You're left with the basic science that if we look at the science today, the best scientific evidence that is available shows us that human-caused climate change is happening. We're seeing an increase in temperature, an average temperature worldwide, and we know that that's linked to humans and our impacts on the environment, mostly through releasing greenhouse gases. And the science is very clear on that.
And last I read, something like 98.7% of scientists agree. There's a few holdouts here and there.
Yes, and we're going to talk about that in the Science Cafe.
Right.
It's a really interesting figure to look at. The science community is anywhere between 97 and 98% in agreement about enough scientific evidence to support human-caused climate change. And when I talk about the scientific community, I'm specifically talking about climate scientists actively engaged in studying our climate systems today. And it's very interesting looking at the difference between the scientific community's thoughts on this topic versus looking at the American public's thought on this topic.
Do you have numbers on the American public?
When you look at the American public, the recent polls that have come out today show that the American public is anywhere from 54 to 58, 59% in agreement that there's enough scientific evidence to support human-caused climate change. And again, referring back to the scientific community, they're at 97 to 98%.
It's interesting because if there were a study that came out that said 97 to 98% of medical research scientists believe, based on evidence, that eating a pound of popcorn a day lengthens your life by 10 years, or shortens your life by 10 years, whatever, people would believe it and they'd say, wow, I'm going to change my relationship toward popcorn. But with this, which is really arguably so much greater than medical impacts of any on any individuals. I mean, this is medical, social, civilization level impacts on every species on the planet. People are just kind of rolling along as if, or almost half of people are rolling along as if it wasn't there at all.
And I think that's one of the challenges when we think about the what can I do piece, is that as individuals, there's things that we can do to change our own behaviors, but that behavior change is not necessarily going to save the entire planet. But collectively, if we all made changes, we can make a big impact. And I think with this topic, since it is long-term and it has these bigger ramifications, I think the general public has a harder time grasping the idea of climate change because it's not happening immediately. I mean, it is happening today, but it's harder to see the signs of it.
And when you do see the signs of it, it's hard for some people to make the connection. So the dead pine forests all over the mountains of Colorado, for example.
Yeah, and even thinking here in Santa Fe, think back to July when how dry it was all around us. And it almost seemed that any spark from any location would have caused everything to catch on fire. And here we are sitting today, and we got some decent rainfall back in August and in September, but we're still well below normal in terms of precipitation for this year. But because we're not in the immediate situation in terms of fire hazard that we were back in July, it's gotten out of the minds of some folks.
We're talking to environmental educator Eileen Everett. So there is this whole question of what we can do, and the buying the fluorescent light bulbs and the keeping air in your tires and blah, 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 all the things that being lower, better gas mileage cars and all those things, and weather stripping. I mean, there's a million little things that people can do, but let's look at the bigger question. Namely, we have a trend going, which is very, very strong. We have a warming climate, warming oceans, acidifying oceans, and can that be reversed? Can that be slowed down? What is necessary for there to be a slowing or a reversal? Given, I mean, it's sort of like turning around a huge barge.
That's been a topic that's been talked about a lot, is what is the tipping point? Is the tipping point a temperature? Is it a carbon dioxide level or some other level of greenhouse gases? Is it a certain level of melting that would occur from ice in Greenland? What is that tipping point? And one of the common numbers that's been thrown out, and there's a whole organization named for this, is 350, which stands for 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere and in our lower atmosphere. And we're above that number today. We're around 390 right now. And I do believe, I wouldn't be involved in doing climate change education if I didn't believe that we can still make an impact. And one of the things I've talked to a lot of people about is thinking about what motivates you to change how you live your life. And we as humans have lots of motivations. Sometimes we do the right thing just because it's the right thing to do. I recycle things every week because I believe that recycling is the right thing to do. But there are other behavior changes I can make that impact the environment, like riding my bicycle, that maybe it's the right thing to do for the environment, but there's a lot of other motivating factors in there. I can save, I don't have to buy gas if I ride my bike, I'm in better shape, I eat better if I ride my bike, and I think it's important as humans to think about what motivates us all to change our behavior.
There is a sense, I think, that many people have, that I sometimes have, of futility, like, okay, I'm getting on my bike twice a week instead of getting in the car or whatever. that in the face of millions of acres of rainforest being cleared for cattle grazing, when rainforests are a carbon sink, they absorb carbon, and these fires to clear them produce huge amounts of carbon. What does it matter, really, those little consumer choices that a few young, healthy activists might in Santa Fe might engage in?
I think two responses to that. The first is an example I'll use from the school that I was teaching at, and we were specifically focused on water conservation in that program, and we talked about how a small change can have a much larger magnifying impact if we all do that change. For example, the simple change of turning off the water when we brush our teeth doesn't sound like it would make much of a difference. If each of us do it, we save 2 gallons of water each time we brush our teeth. That's 4 gallons of water a day for everybody who brushes their teeth at least 2 times a day. For a classroom of kids, with those 25 kids, that's around 100 gallons of water saved a day. If we multiply that out over a whole year, that's 36,500 gallons of water, which, starting out from the 2 gallons of water, that doesn't sound like much of an impact. But if you magnify it up to that 36,500 gallons of water, that is a pretty large impact. One of the things that I've talked about a lot with climate change education and the What Can I Do piece, I've been very focused on looking at our food choices and the impact that our food has, specifically local food. One thing I did when I worked down at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science was help support the Degrees of Change New Mexico's Climate Forecast exhibit. And one of the pieces in that exhibit is actually looking at our food print and our food choices. And a lot of people used to ask me, well, why even think about food? Why does that matter? And when you look at the research, our food production in the U.S. contributes anywhere from 1/5 to 1/3 of the amount of greenhouse gases released as a result of the actions of Americans. And so 1/3 to 1/5 is a pretty significant number.
What are the big carbon producers in terms of the food that we eat?
So there's 3 main driving factors that affect what our carbon footprint looks like for our food choices. The first is, where is the food grown? Is it local, or does it have to be transported over a long distance? The other piece is looking at, did it come from an animal, or did it come from a plant? Animals are going to always require more resources to produce, whether it be meat or dairy or eggs. It's always going to require more resources just because it's an animal versus a plant.
Although even within that, I mean, beef requires so much more than
definitely,
chicken.
Definitely, definitely. And there's definitely variation, especially with the meat. I mean, beef has the largest carbon footprint. Chicken typically has the smallest. And pork and fish are in the middle. And so just looking at those choices as well.
And I have to say, beef also has the largest water use footprint, if you call it that.
Yes, water print, yes.
So what about junk food versus healthy food? Does that play a role?
So the third piece is looking at how processed your food is. If the least, typically, the less processing that you do with your food, the smaller the footprint it has.
And what about pesticides and fertilizers?
Those all play an impact, too. Typically, though, when I try to teach people to think about their food choices, I go back to those 3 main pieces of local versus grown far away, process versus less process or no processing, and animal products versus plant products.
So there is a kind of happy dovetail between eating less meat and being healthier and eating less meat and having a lower carbon footprint.
Yeah, and I think that one of the ways I present to looking at our food choices is it's like anything else, that we all have choices on what we can eat. I personally choose to eat some meat, but I'm very careful about what kind of meat, what type of meat, and where it's grown and where it comes from. And I think everybody has their own choices for food. But again, you know, I think it's really important, especially looking at if we ate more plants in our diets, generally we would be healthier.
There's another important piece of this. We're talking to environmental educator Eileen Everett, and that is the population of the planet. What are we at, 7 billion now or something like that? We get up to 9 billion, and again, my little choices around whether or not I eat bacon and eggs seems completely non-existent or futile in the face of 2 billion new people.
It's very true, and I think again, looking at this topic of climate change, we have to think about all different facets that impact the system. Our population being one, that over the last 150 to 200 years, our population has doubled and then doubled again, and maybe on the way to doubling a third time.
No way, 12 billion?
Maybe.
I thought 9 billion.
9 billion, hopefully. Hopefully we won't go past that. But I think we're on the track that we're continuing to grow right now, and we're on this track. So that's a piece of it. And specifically, if we look here in the United States, generally Americans tend to have a higher carbon footprint than citizens in other countries. Not to say that we have the highest carbon footprint in the world, but Americans...
I thought we did.
We actually do not. There's areas in the Middle East that actually, countries that individuals per capita have a larger carbon footprint than we do. And areas, of course, in the world that have much smaller carbon footprints than we do.
I have a friend who was working for a company that was doing R&D to come up with, I mean, I think they were pretty far advanced, I don't know where it is right now, but to make a photovoltaic solar panel that doesn't use those very rare minerals, but uses basically readily available materials to make electricity out of solar panels. And their goal and the way they were trying to sell themselves was being cost competitive with coal.
Mm-hmm.
Once solar is cost competitive with coal, how does that affect? I mean, and I think it's an inevitability. I mean, as long as there's any money whatsoever for research and development, it's going to happen. Just a question of when. What happens then? I mean, could we suddenly have the proliferation of electricity produced by the sun and all this stuff just turns around within a few years?
I think it's a longer term process than just a few years. If we stopped using oil, gas, and coal today, which wouldn't be a feasible situation to put us in, but if we did that, it would still take a while for the planet to heal itself. I actually have no doubt that our planet is going to be fine. I think the larger question that we all need to be asking ourselves is, do we as humans want to continue to exist on this planet? Because the path that we're on right now is not a good path for our own existence.
It's good for certain insects.
Yeah, it's good for, there's certain animal life, plant life, different microorganisms. There are certain species that, no matter what happens in the future, would probably be okay. Not to say we wouldn't lose a lot of species along the way, but part of my concern as being a climate change educator is also, how do we preserve humans as well?
And so, what do you find when you talk to elementary school students?
I find generally with elementary school students, most of those students have very little awareness about this topic of climate change and specifically global warming. They maybe have heard about the terms, but they know very little about the science. They know very little about the greenhouse effect and what that is and what causes that and how that has changed. And they know a little bit about the what can I do piece.
What is your hope if you could get together with all the other environmental educators in the country and share notes? What do you hope to give to the students you're teaching?
My hope for students of all ages, youth and adults, would be that we can do a better job of teaching everyone where they get their information from and how to weed through all that information that we're bombarded with on a daily basis. Because I think it relates to this topic, and we can see the same story that repeats itself over and over again with things like the tobacco industry, the ozone hole. We see the same story that plays through, that the science is doubted by the general public for quite a while. And how do we do a better job of really teaching where is the science and how do we get to that science?
So media literacy, essentially.
I think so, yeah.
Eileen Everett is an environmental and climate change educator. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.